Hi there, welcome back to Brown Game Strong. This is episode 3 of season 2, and I'm your host, Mithali. Our guest today is a dear friend of mine. She's a lawyer, she's a dancer. That's how we actually met. We met at a dance class quite a few months ago now. She is a traveler. She's also the co-founder of South Asian Sisters Speak, which you may be aware of, but if you aren't, it is a wonderful organization that aims to create a safe space for South Asian women and non-binary people to share their experiences. And this is done through a variety of events that they organize, such as book clubs and roundtables, among many others, to open up those conversations around difficult topics, to share experiences, to share ideas. And I've attended a couple of their sessions. I felt like I was learning so much, and I felt heard and seen and safe, but also I felt like I was learning in a safe environment. That is why I think spaces like that are so important. So Shirin is all of these things, but so much more than that. And we talk about lots of different topics, having a full-time career and still managing a full-time side hustle. We talk about being a doer versus being a thinker, and upbringing and being highly academic and not always fitting into the South Asian diaspora, because back then it was cool to be a coconut and it was finding our feet in university, you know, almost coming full circle back to our roots and realizing why representation is so important. We talk about imposter syndrome, or not explicitly, but we definitely cover those emotions. And then, of course, the entire topic around grief, why it's so important to talk about grief across communities. And it's not just the South Asian community that struggles to talk about grief openly. It's just a very, very uncomfortable topic for everyone. So having had a really personal experience with grief this year, Shirin shares her thoughts around the topic and how to also support someone who might be grieving, which I think is going to be very, very useful. I know it was for me. I tend to walk on eggshells and not really know how to behave or what to say around someone who is grieving or going through something like that. As a disclaimer, I just want to mention that we do cover some pretty serious topics around grief. So if that is going to be, you know, triggering for you, then please be conscious. And we start covering this topic around 45 minutes into the episode. So just so that you're aware. Finally, I just want to say, if you want to reach out to Shirin, you can do on Twitter. So her handle is Shirin Fulner, and I will add it on the description as well in the episode. You can also reach out on the SAS page. So it's we are without a space underscore SAS. So SASS. Again, I'll add it in the description. So yeah, without further ado, I present to you Shirin Shah. Thank you so much for joining us today at Brown Game Strong. It's so great to have you on, and I just can't wait to have a chat with you today. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. I've been trying to enjoy the sun, like the one few days that you get sun. So yeah, I'm doing good.
How's everything been with the past few months, and obviously with COVID and lockdown? How have you been coping with work and everything?
Yeah, it's been interesting for sure. I think like all the things that I normally rely on in terms of, I'm like a very busy, productive person. Like I'm always doing something and I'm always going between things and like seeing my friends, and it's been quite different to not have that. And so I think some of the coping mechanisms and things that I normally rely on to like keep me sane haven't quite been the same. So yeah, and I think moving home, like back in with my mom, is like, that's had its added challenges as well, like after living out for a couple of years. So it's required a lot of adjusting, but at the same time, you know, you feel really lucky, I think, to just like have somewhere to go home to, and like my mom's been cooking for me, and like I've literally not had to do anything. Yeah, that's been like
definitely going back home. So I went back home about a month ago, and the luxury of having home cooked food is just unmatchable to anything else, I find. So how have you been coping with working from home?
Yeah, it's been actually okay overall. Like most of the initial part of lockdown, like the first kind of 5 months or so, was my last parts of my training as a solicitor, like training solicitor, and my team wasn't very busy, so it actually was quite chilling. And in some ways, like with running SAS, so like South Asian Sisters Speak, which is my little side hustle, it was a lot better because I could just flip between things really easily. My work hours weren't so bad, so we could do like virtual events, and it was nice to be able to manage those few things a lot more easily than when I'm in the office. But I think motivation sometimes has definitely been lacking. Like there were some tasks which were like longer term that I swear I just kept putting them off, and there was like no accountability because I wasn't seeing my colleagues. It's like, yeah, I just haven't had the time to action it. But I was like, I definitely did. I'm just lacking the motivation to do it. But yeah, it wasn't too bad. I think the only difficulty was I had only joined that team like 3 weeks before. And so doing most of it in lockdown just meant, in terms of like relationship building and things like that, that was a little bit tricky. And I'm having the same thing now because I qualified as a solicitor and moved back into one of my previous teams. But it's a very big team, and I don't really know that many people. And I think when you're quite junior and you want to learn and you want people to ask questions with, it has been a little bit challenging, I think, just not having that social aspect. There's a lot, like you're just not visible, right? Whilst when you're sitting at your desk in an office, you are. So yeah, it's been easy. And I think in a weird way, actually, when you're working from home, I was saying this to one of my friends, like none of the other stuff really matters. Like you actually just have to think about your job and do you enjoy the content of your job? Because all of the social aspect or being in the city or whatever other things normally come into play, I think when you're working in like normal settings, you don't really have that. It's actually just you on your own in a, you know, with a computer, and you really have to think like, wow, do I find this work interesting? Does it challenge me or not? I think that's been something different as well, because you have nothing to distract you.
Yeah, that is so true. It's just made us all reevaluate how we feel about the choices we've made. I've gone through a pretty similar thing as well, where I was like, right, you know, I have X number of months to figure out what I'm doing. Like I need to, you know, it has to be conscious. Like if I stay here, it's a conscious decision. And I think COVID has actually forced us into that contemplation and just sitting with our thoughts and, you know, all of our life decisions. So it has been a time of reflection, which I think is actually, in a way, I see it as a blessing. Because living in London, both of us, like young professionals, it's so easy to just be running around all the time and not actually have time to step back and look at the bigger picture.
Yeah, definitely. But saying that also, I think the separation between like work and home, that has been tricky. I mean, I work in the living room in my mum's house, and when I finish work, I literally get up, walk 2 seconds to the sofa. And so I think there's, even though it's more flexible and I work quite long hours, so that's been nice, I don't think I am having that same separation between like work time and like relaxing time. I think a lot of people have found that to be the case though.
Once things do sort of start to go back to normal, what would be your ideal working week in terms of the ratio between working from home and being in the office?
I think for me, I would actually prefer going in for a week and then not being in the next week. So this is partly just because I'm going between like my flat and my mom's place. So I think everybody's a little bit skeptical of how much the industry will actually change, because I suppose I question whether, if this does all go away and we're in like a world without a pandemic, whether the expectation will just go back to what it was before, because this has been seen as like really extenuating circumstances as opposed to something we should have been moving towards anyway. There's always been a lot of respect for like wanting flexible working if you have a family, but I hope we move towards a culture where if you want flexible working for whatever reasons, like whether it's because you want to spend more time with like your family who lives somewhere else, or you've got a side hustle, or you've got other interests, I hope that we start to respect that in work culture, because I just don't think it is the norm. I think quite interesting how we also are asked you towards why, what's a justified reason for wanting to flexibly work. And I hope that becomes a little bit more broad-minded.
I agree with that. So moving on to a bit more about you, can you tell me a little bit about where you're from, where you grew up?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in North West London in Harrow, elevations. And I'm a Gujarati, but my parents, and my mum's from Tanzania and my dad's from my mum's from Kenya and my dad was from Tanzania. Basically, my grandparents moved from Gujarat to East Africa in like the 30s, and then my parents were born there in the 50s and eventually moved here I think in the early 70s. My dad actually moved on his own to Leicester at 16, which I find absolutely crazy. Like, I can't even imagine what that would have been like. Me at 16 would not be capable of doing that. And my mom moved, I think, at 17 with her family. And yeah, so that's where I grew up. And I grew up around in an area that's full of a lot of Gujaratis, to be honest. But I went to private school probably half an hour from where I grew up, and there was still a lot of Indians. It was probably like 30% Indian in my school, and then 30% Jewish, and 30% everything else. I think now I look back at it and I'm like, wow, okay, that experience definitely had a very formative role in developing me into who I am. And I think I also went to a very, very highly academic school that's probably one of the top girls in the country. And I think being molded in that environment had two impacts. One was I never grew up with this idea of like, you're a girl, you can't do something, because like everyone was of this certain level of caliber. It was like, you want to be a doctor, you can be a doctor, you want to be a lawyer, you can be a lawyer. There was no idea of, or no sense of, that's a man's career, or like that's something that men would do, right? And I thought that was really amazing to grow up in an environment where women were pushed to do whatever you wanted to do, because we were all really intelligent and like getting the top grades and things like that. And I think being in that environment definitely pushed me to want to do better, because we used to have this at the end of the year when we had exams, you would get your grades and you would get the median. So that was the middle person in our entire year and what grade they got. And I was always in the bottom half. I really struggled to get like above the median. I think I only ever got it in like a few exams. And I remember that motivated me to always, when it came to important things like GCSEs or A-levels and things like that, wanting to prove that I was as good as all of these other people. But I think that environment stuck with me for a long time of like, I didn't actually think I was very intelligent, because everyone in my school was like the top 1%, right? And so for me, I was in the bottom of this like 1%, but you didn't have that greater perspective of the fact that in the world at large, you were all highly intelligent. And in the end, we all got A's and A stars. Like, it literally didn't make any difference in the end. But on a day-to-day basis, the way that teachers treated some of you in comparison to others, I used to always think I was just not intelligent at all. And I remember when I went to university, my friends were just like, what? Like, you're studying. So I studied philosophy, politics, and economics at Warwick. And my friends were always like, how can you think you're not intelligent? You're doing like very prestigious degree at like a top 5 uni. And it took me a really long time to actually say, I'm actually pretty smart. I don't think I really embraced that for a long time, just because I was in this environment where I was the bottom of the smart people, as it were.
Do you think that then translates into maybe some of the inherent behaviors you might have now with not feeling like, you know, you are successful as you are? Do you feel like that upbringing has sort of made you almost hold yourself back and like not celebrate yourself as much as you'd like to?
It's a weird catch-22, because I don't think I would be as ambitious as I am if I hadn't grown up in that environment. I think the reason why I do so much and I like have all these other interests and I pursue lots of different things and I'm always thinking about the next thing is because of that. But at the same time, yeah, I don't think I often give myself credit for some of the successes and things that I've achieved. And it's something I've been reflecting a lot on recently, because I just want to have that introspection to say like, actually, you know what, that was an amazing achievement, and to give myself that space to just say like, okay, you did well, like that was, you know, give yourself a pat on the back. And also I think the second thing is not being afraid to shout about those achievements, because even where I do think them myself, I've never really shouted about like, oh, you know, I did this amazing thing, or I'm sharing it with other people, like maybe close friends and family, but that's it. There's nothing shameful, I think, about saying, you know what, I did something really well, I worked really hard for it, and I am really proud of myself. I think there's a culture where we've grown up where it's like, oh, you shouldn't boast, like boasting, especially as a woman, it was like, you shouldn't boast about what you're doing. Like, you know, be, just work hard, be quiet. I think it's also a South Asian kind of cultural thing as well, of like, just put your head down and work really hard and you'll reap the rewards just from doing that, right? But I actually think it's really important that we start to shout about those things, because it shouldn't be shameful to just talk about credit that you deserve, that you've got. The stereotype of being a South Asian woman can sometimes be, you know, being quiet and not. I used to always get told this when I was actually at family things. I'm very opinionated, and it's a little like hypocritical sometimes, because like, you sent me to this school where I'm like doing really well and I'm surrounded by all these kinds of people, and you want me to be very, very academically like bright and to get these top grades. But then at the same time, if I'm in a room and I'm sharing my opinions and I'm like telling somebody, actually, I don't think what you're thinking is correct, or like, you need to think about it in a different way, you've often told like, why are you being so loud? Like, you shouldn't be so opinionated and so loud in those circumstances. And so I think some of that comes from that as well. It's like, as South Asian women, we're often expected to be a little bit just quiet and like behind the scenes, and you do all this work and you do so much stuff, but you don't make a big fuss about it. Yeah, and I also think we have this like competitive culture between people sometimes in South Asia. Like, you can hear, you know, those like moms, and they're always talking about, oh, my kid, and then they're like, oh no, but my kid did this as well. And I think for that reason, sometimes like, we can put one another down, I think, as well. And especially if somebody's out there being like, oh, I did this and I did really well, you're like, who does she think she is, like, talking about how great she is?
Yeah, that's so true. We live in like a bit of a juxtaposition where like, there's an expectation to be really smart and really successful and have a good job in a big company and all of these things. And then on the other hand, at the dinner table, when you have like an uncle or an auntie saying something really inappropriate or just completely politically incorrect, I don't know, then there's an expectation to just quietly listen, even if you think it's wrong, because it's like, oh no, but you know, bring shame to the family if you start speaking up. They'll be like, oh, she's not been brought up properly.
Yeah, exactly. And I've just had the response so many times of like, oh, you know, we've lived longer, like, you're young, you don't know anything. Particularly I think when my family have made maybe slightly racist comments, I think, to other ethnic minorities and like perpetuated stereotypes and things like that, and I will always be that person who will question it, and then they'll be like, yeah, but you just wait, like, you barely lived a life there. You don't have a right to pass an opinion on this.
It's always like, oh, but we know better than you because we've been around longer. Yeah, sometimes with our elders, there's a lack of awareness about what's actually happening today. They'll be living in some like 30 years ago world where, you know, things were very different, and they'll be like, back in my day, you know. So you mentioned that you grew up in a school that was, there was quite a lot of South Asians. Were you ever made to feel other or different? What kind of were your struggles back then with your own identity? And did you ever feel like you were singled out for being South Asian, or did you feel like you struggled within the South Asian community itself?
Yeah, I was never othered in the sense of like being South Asian. Of the South Asians that there were, which was a lot, the majority were Gujarati. So I was like very much surrounded by people from very similar backgrounds to myself. But I think the kind of sad thing is, you would think being surrounded by so many other Asians, you would always be embracing your culture. It was actually the opposite. And often to be cool was to be the coconut. It was to be the South Asian person who wasn't really into their culture, had mostly white friends, you know, was hanging out with guys and like all of this kind of stuff. So I think we really didn't embrace our background, because I think it's partly because there were so many of us that in order to differentiate yourself from all the other Gujaratis and all the other Indians or all the other South Asians was to basically be white. And I think we did also maybe put them on a pedestal in terms of how they behaved and like, you know, their attitudes towards things and stuff like that. So I didn't struggle with that. I just found it a little bit odd. And I think it was only when I went to university, where most of my university friends aren't South Asian, and they were just like, wow, like, being Indian is so cool. And I finally came full circle to being able to openly embrace it. And I think that's why, you know, when I was 21, I was in a position where I was like, actually, I would love to found SAS, like something which is so focused on South Asian women and embracing our culture. And I think now anyone who talks to me is so much at the forefront of who I am. And I don't think I would have had that if I hadn't been then put in an environment where I was the only Indian or the only South Asian person. And weirdly, I think my non-Asian friends maybe embrace it more than my Asian friends ever had. And then in terms of struggles at school, girls' school is a very interesting environment. It's very, very cliquey. Not as bad as Mean Girls, but it is a little bit like that. You know, people have their groups. And if you're in a group, you are always in that group and you get invited to things and certain things like that. But if you are the kind of person like me, where I have a lot of individual friendships rather than being in groups, it really doesn't work very well because you kind of don't belong anywhere.
You're a floater.
Yeah, I'm definitely a floater. And that really didn't work in girls' school. And I remember forcing myself, I think after a couple of years of like basically forcing myself to fit in with this certain group of Gujaratis that were in my class. And I ended up being friends with them maybe from like year 9 to year 11. But I think I was like really forcing myself to fit into that group just so I could belong somewhere, because when you weren't in a group and you were a floater, like you just kind of didn't belong anywhere, so you wouldn't get invited to things or no one really had your back, that kind of thing. So I'm trying to think how I necessarily changed my person. I think I just toned myself down and tried to agree with what they were doing and like trying to just like more of a joker, or you know, deal with them taking the piss out of me, that kind of thing, to just fit into this group. And then I think in sixth form it was a little bit more easy to be a floater, and especially because I didn't do traditional South Asian subjects, I didn't do any sciences, so the people in my class were like a much bigger range. We were put into new classes and my class was like a much broader kind of range of people from different backgrounds, and because of what you were studying it was a lot easier to be a floater basically. And then university was like the ultimate place to be a floater. It was really great for that. But yeah, I think I definitely toned myself down for a few years in order to just get by, to belong somewhere.
Yeah, I relate to that. I was also a little bit of a floater, and like for me it was slightly different because I wasn't surrounded by South Asians. So definitely uni is such a blessing because you could just straight up avoid the people you didn't, you know, get along with. So you mentioned SAS, so let's go on to that. So how did that idea come about? Tell us from the very start.
Yeah, so I think for me, university, as I said, like pretty much not being surrounded by many South Asians or Asians in general was like a real wake-up call to me. I had grown up in an environment where everyone knew about Indian culture and specifically Gujarati culture. Like they knew the differences between all of these different kind of South Asian cultures. And then I went to university and I was constantly asked every day multiple times, like, where are you really from? And I think it was one of the first times I had constantly been asked that question. And I actually realized, wow, I'm a minority in this country. And I don't think I'd ever had that feeling growing up because of where I had grown up. That was then exacerbated. I spent 6 months traveling after backpacking on my own. And it was a similar thing, actually, when you're traveling, because you're surrounded mostly by like white Westerners who are traveling. And both them, but also the locals, especially when I was in Asia, they would be like, okay, wait, you're British, but you look like us. Like, we're a bit confused. So I think when I came back, I was just really conscious of the fact that I'm a minority, and I really wanted to create a space where basically South Asian women could specifically talk about all the different issues that face them. And although growing up we kind of spoke about it a little bit to our friends, we never had a wider platform, I think, where we more openly spoke about it. And I think I was really, really inspired by Black feminists who have always, I saw, to be a lot more loud and would talk about these issues on a much bigger platform. So yeah, I wanted to create that, and I'd written a blog actually about being South Asian on Tinder and all of the microaggressions that you get on dating apps. And I got introduced to Shibo, who is my co-founder now. She wrote I think, an article about her experience going back to India, where she still has a lot of family and how they perceive her. Yeah. Turns out we both grew up in Harrow, down the road from each other. Mm-hmm. And we went for, I think, a tea. And to be honest, the idea of SAS was born like very much there in that first meeting. We both felt like we wanted to create that space for women like us to just discuss those issues, bring people together and be more open about it. And then it's just been a journey since then. Like, between the idea and our first event was probably like 10 months or so, just getting funding, like building a brand, all of those different things. And yeah, now it's been 4 years and we've done such a range of different projects and different events. And I think we have a really lovely community of people who keep coming back to what we're doing. And it's been amazing. It started out very much as a, let's do one event and see how it goes. And there was just such a great response that, I'm really glad that it is where it is now.
Both done such a fantastic job. Like, I've attended a couple of your sessions, one of your book clubs and one of your roundtable discussions as well. And I just think it's just amazing that you both do that on the side of a full-time job. It's very inspiring to know that you started it off quite organically. It all sort of just happened and there wasn't like a set intention from the very beginning. Like, before you even met, she thought that I need a co-founder, I need to do this. This is exactly how it's going to happen. And I think there's some comfort in knowing that you can just take the first step and then take the next step and then just see how things go. What is it like for you to run this alongside someone? It must have been a journey, right?
Yeah, of course, it was a journey. I mean, I think, as I mentioned, like, we met and like we basically started SAS at the same time as having met, right? So it's not like we were friends and we knew each other before. Our friendship and our like relationship as co-founders have definitely grown in, like, you know, alongside each other in parallel. And I think because we also started it very organically, not really having an idea of where is this going to go? Is it going to be a long-term thing? What are we going to do after? We obviously had disagreements of where we saw it going at times, because we suddenly were then like, okay, this is more, we can do so much more with this, but how should we do that? And we have definitely had different opinions on that. And I think when you don't maybe know somebody before, and to be honest, I think even if you went into it with a friend, you see a different side to somebody when you're running something and building something together. And it's the same with, you know, your colleagues in the workplace, but communication and how people perceive what you say and what's the best way to communicate to them and like give feedback to them, and also have open conversations where you can disagree but in a way that is productive and respectful and all of those kinds of things. I think that takes a lot of time, and it has also, because we were forming this in the process, I think now we're at a point where we very, very clearly know what SAS stands for, and we've done loads of different projects in the time, and sometimes we've actually enjoyed them all but said, maybe in hindsight this isn't what we're going to carry on doing. And so I think after 4 years we so clearly know that what it stands for as a brand, that there's a lot more synergy because we are so on the same line of this is what SAS stands for and this is what SAS needs and this is what we should do. But that didn't come straight away because of how organically it grew. And so I think in that process, we obviously had to figure out the best way for us to work together. And we're quite different, I think, sometimes in, like, I'm just a doer. Like, I just do stuff. Like, if you tell me, I'll just, like, get it done. And Shuta is very much more introspective. And it's such a beautiful, beautiful quality to have. And I think we've come to complement each other really well in that way. But because of that difference at times, I think you have to find the best way to communicate with each other.
Yeah, I think that takes time. It's like a relationship you have to nurture, right? What's your favorite, or not favorite, but maybe most memorable event that you guys have run together?
I think the most memorable one, there's two. I think the first one would be, we did this showcase at Tara Arts last year, where we partnered with them and did like a 10-week writing course with 10 of our regular book club attendees, and they were basically writing responses to Mira Sayle's book Life Isn't All Ha Ha Hee Hee, and they performed it and Mira Sayle came, which was just insane because obviously growing up in the UK with, like, goodness gracious me, she's just like an icon. So she came and, like, did a Q&A and absolutely loved the pieces and the responses to it. But I think to work with other South Asian women who all have full-time jobs and give them that space to create and respond and perform and to like a sold out theatre was amazing. It also just really, really felt like we were, I don't think you still get that many, you know, things in the arts which are just like South Asian focused, let alone women who work full time. Like you would never get that opportunity, right? So to give them that space, I think was really amazing. And to see the response from the attendees and how much that is wanted or needed was really great. And then I think the second one would be the roundtable we did recently on resilience that I co-chaired with Sibyl from Two Brown Girls, and we had Pruna Bell and Leah Sether from the other books. And it's a topic, and I think the things that we touched on, such as like grief and mental health and strength and all of those things, are things I'm personally very, very interested in and also have been reflecting a lot on myself. But to be in a virtual roundtable with two South Asian women who I really look up to and who speak so honestly and openly about some very, very difficult topics, and topics that we don't openly talk about in South Asian culture at all, was really powerful to me. And I felt very lucky to be able to chair that conversation and be there.
Yeah, I attended that, and it got pretty emotional at one point. I definitely cried a little bit, but it was just incredible to see. I see so much representation now, and it's something that like younger me never saw. And on top of that, to see women who, you know, look like me in terms of skin color and things like that, to be speaking about these topics so openly about their experiences, I think it's just so refreshing. And I think it's just such a wonderful place to learn from other people who in many ways will have shared a lot of experiences with us, and we can see parts of us in them. So going on to just how you balance us with work, do you find yourself sometimes slipping? How do you manage your time?
I get asked this a lot, because there's working a full-time job and then there's being a corporate M&A lawyer, and that's a very different thing. That is much more than a full-time job. I don't do it very consciously, to be honest. Like I think it's really finding what works for you. Like some people, for example, I think have to set aside some time and say, you know, I'm going to spend these few hours on the weekend or the evening working my like side hustle. For me, it's just very intuitive. Like I will have my Gmail up sometimes at work, and I'll just drop a few emails for like SaaS related things that will take me a couple of minutes. I'll just respond to WhatsApps whenever. I move between work and doing SaaS stuff very quickly and just quite seamlessly. I think I have always been a little bit like that. My parents, when I was in school, I honestly did so many extracurriculars I can't even explain to you. I was that kid on the weekend who was going to swimming, then going to dance class, and like eating my food in the car on the way between the two. Like honestly, I was constantly doing stuff, and constantly every evening had like some kind of extracurricular. So I think I've honed in on this skill of just being able to flip between so many different things quite quickly, because I think some people feel that space to like get into the mindset. I actually find it quite easy to go between the two. And I think I mentioned earlier, I have a nature of just being a doer. I'm like, okay, let me just get this done. But saying that, I also probably don't know how to switch off at all. I don't think I know how to not do anything. Yeah. And I also think genuinely, when you really love doing something, it doesn't feel like a burden. Like to me, I just really love SaaS, and like it's such a passion of mine that it doesn't feel like work. Yeah, I really don't feel like I'm doing extra work.
As a doer, do you think what drives you is that sense of accomplishment? Or do you get a bit of an adrenaline rush when you complete a task?
I don't think I do, you know. I don't think it doesn't make me feel good. It's just the way I am. And I kind of can't explain why it is like that. But maybe it does give me a bit of adrenaline. I'll have to act on that next time.
I know, because I've actually transformed my personality over the years, like definitely running more side stuff now with this podcast and a few other things. I used to always be a thinker. So up until maybe when I started working, it was always, you know, I would think up all of these scenarios in my head and, you know, read loads of books on success and business and, you know, self-help and all of this. And I remember like the way I used to speak back then, it was like I was someone who'd not really achieved much, but really wanted to do loads of things. And then when I started working, I started shifting that into actually doing. And now I no longer know whether I'm inherently a thinker or a doer, because definitely it is my nature to reflect a bit more and also procrastinate from actually starting the task. So I'm not someone who just like goes straight into it the way you do. At the same time, I think when you do have a lot of responsibilities and you're kind of accountable to loads of people, then you have to, like, you don't have a choice. You don't have the time to think. You just have to keep going because there's like 10 things to get done by the end of the day. So that's the reason why I asked you, because I wanted to kind of see if it's something that specifically motivates you or if it's just kind of an inherent part of the way you are. Okay, so going on to, I guess, friends and family as well, how have they reacted to SAS and how have they been part of your journey with it?
Yeah, I think for a lot of my friends have been super, super supportive. It's been interesting, and there's a mix. Like, I think for some of my South Asian friends, they were like, this is awesome, this is the space we've always wanted. But I even have South Asian friends who haven't engaged with SAS at all, and I think don't see it as a space that they need or that they want. So yeah, some have been incredibly supportive, and I think especially with our first few events, like, we leaned on those networks to help us, like, get someone to do some videos, get someone to do some photography, and keep costs as slim as possible. So yeah, I feel really lucky to have had a network of people who've been so supportive in helping it grow. Yeah. And then equally, the kinds of people I've been able to meet through being in that circle and being through SAS has just led to some really, really beautiful new relationships with people where I think we think similarly and we're on the same track and we want to achieve some similar things, and that's been really beautiful as well. In terms of family, my parents have like come to events and things like that. My mom always tries to come. I think it's been interesting because I think my mom has sometimes been like, why do you guys need to talk about this stuff so much? Because I think they're a little bit like, why are you guys always having an identity crisis? Because maybe they just didn't have the time or luxury, I suppose, to talk about these things. I think my brother has always helped at like a lot of our events, and I think he often feels a lot of the topics that we touch on are actually very relevant to South Asian men, but South Asian men don't really talk about it and there isn't really a space for them. So I've been quite lucky. I do think at times there's been a bit of tension with being the kind of person that I am and being so busy both with work and doing other things. I think my family more have sometimes been like, but you don't have time, like, you're always doing something, you always have meetings in the evening, so you always are going to do SAS stuff, and maybe sometimes feel like I don't have enough time for them. I think sometimes balancing all of those different things can be a little bit tricky in terms of whether people feel like they're getting enough of your time or as much time as they want, but ultimately I think you have to do what's best for yourself.
Yeah, nobody can be in two places at once. How do you cope with that guilt of kind of sometimes feeling like you're not there for your family?
I honestly really think that like guilt is such an inherent part of being a South Asian. Like, I remember when I moved out a couple of years ago when I started working, I knew I needed it for my own mental health and also like to live closer to work so I could just work home and like not have to spend so much time traveling. And I just felt so guilty for so long about like not living with parents and not being there for them. And it's a very tough balance, I think, to strike, but I think you really do sometimes have to put yourself in the center, and you have to do what's right for yourself and what's going to make you happy. And doing SAS, for example, makes me very, very happy, and it's something that I'm really passionate about. And although it may seem harsh, but it's like the best situation for your mental health, whether that's moving out or whatever it is. I don't think the guilt ever goes. I don't know. I think the guilt is there, but the guilt is still there for sure. And I feel it a lot sometimes. I think you just have to try and find a way to quieten that feeling of guilt and try to balance it for the best way that is for yourself.
Yeah, it's so important to actually speak about the fact that as South Asian women, we are guilted into so much. You know, family's everything. And it, you know, sometimes I'm just like, why am I not just back home with my parents? Yet here I am, you know, living on my own, like trying to figure out my life. And you do feel like, you know, you wish you could spend more time with them. You do wish you could be in more places. Like sometimes nowadays, recently as well, I've just felt like I wish I could just clone myself and just please everyone and please myself too.
I remember actually when I first started working, I really, really felt that pressure because I was, I moved out and I was trying to balance out the time. My parents feeling like I was giving them enough time. I was in a relationship at the time, my friends, then working like super crazy hours. I remember for the first few months actually realizing I wasn't doing what was making me happy. I was basically running around trying to give everybody else enough time so that they felt they were getting the amount of my time that they wanted. Like I would, you know, probably spend the whole weekend at home because I knew that's what my parents wanted, but that also meant I wasn't seeing my friends and doing things that I enjoyed, or like going to the theatre or whatever else it was. So I think a lot of the time it's so easy for us to please everybody else and not really think about yourself. You just have to find a way that works for you. Like I know because of being South Asian that I could never be completely selfish or completely just like doing everything that I want. I remember my friends at uni just being like, oh, but like you're an adult, just go do what you want. And I'm like, no. I do things, I definitely push my parents and like do things that maybe they wouldn't completely agree with, but I have to at least get them mildly on my side. Like I couldn't just go off and do something that they would completely against.
Yeah, because there's a responsibility, right? There's a gratitude that we all have for like everything that they've done for us, and you wouldn't want to upset them. It comes from like the way we've been brought up as well to value these things. So I think it's beautiful, like if you do strike that balance somehow. And I think you will always go a bit more in one direction over the other sometimes. But yeah, it's nice to also just acknowledge it and realize that actually we are stuck between these two worlds sometimes, and we're just trying to figure that out and cut ourselves a little bit of slack as well.
Yeah.
If we find ourselves not being the perfect daughter or the perfect girlfriend or the perfect friend. So I guess just with relation to SAS, my last question to you would be, would you ever consider going full time with it?
I don't think so. I think when you're really passionate about something, but it also is not the source of your livelihood and you don't depend on it for financial like income and things like that, I think there's something really freeing about it, because you can just love it for what it is and do it as much as it like feeds your soul, rather than having that pressure of it also being what feeds your lifestyle. And you know, we're very much like, we're not a money making organization, we're very much not for profit, and we do as much stuff as we can for free and we get grants and just cover our costs. Like nothing about it is trying to make money, and I'm sure we could create a model where that's the case, but I just don't think that's what drives us. Do I wish that one day I could work a little bit more flexibly and, you know, have a day a week where I work on my side hustles, whether that's SAS, whether that's something else? Yeah, absolutely. Like, I would love to have more time to dedicate to different projects that I am passionate about, and obviously have a job where I can work 4 days a week and that's ample to fulfill my lifestyle requirements and things like that, for sure. But I don't think for me it's like a full-time thing. I just think that would require changing it into something that it's not.
That's such a good point, that you would actually have to adapt it and mold it and turn it into something that's money making and, you know, more focused on that rather than on the message and the purpose. And who says that it's not possible to just continue doing this, you know, having your law career, having SAS and everything else that you want to do, and just juggling all of them and, you know, trying to basically keep all the plates spinning. I think that's definitely a world that we are seeing now and in the future that will be more normal. Even the fact that we call it side hustles, like why is it a side hustle? Is it not just another part of me? Like, does my 9-to-5 job or 9-to-6 job have to be my main thing that's defining me? At the start of this podcast, you mentioned that you've gone through quite a bit of change, and we also talked on grief a little bit. I wanted to kind of speak to you a little bit about that. So how has that change impacted your life this year?
So my dad passed away in February after getting quite suddenly ill at the end of last year. He was, I don't know, that like uncle in his 60s who had no underlying health conditions and then suddenly deteriorated and got diagnosed with like an incurable neurological condition. And so yeah, he eventually passed away in February. And yeah, it's been a very interesting time. So I don't think we talk about grief enough. In terms of like death as it is. I weirdly, probably for somebody of my age, had quite a few instances with death, as it were. Anyway, like two of my mum's brother and my mum's brother-in-law passed away about 10 years ago, and then my granddad passed away like a few years ago. So in my family, like my immediate family on my mum's side, I mean, there's four men in that generation and three have passed away now. So It was quite a normal thing in terms of coming to terms with death and like knowing what happens. But saying that, obviously, when it happens in your own house, in your own family, it's a completely different thing. And it really made me think I had no idea what my cousins went through all those years ago when they lost their fathers. So yeah, it's been really, I think particularly with parents, because you don't know a life without your parents. And I'm talking about it in a situation of somebody who had a very nuclear family. My parents were both very present in my life. They were still, you know, they're married for 40 years. So for me, my parents were both very involved in my upbringing and, you know, on a day-to-day basis. So I never knew a life without my parents, right? And so for my dad to pass away, it shakes your sense of self and also like your support system, because that's somebody you've always had there, you've always had to rely on, right? And you actually will never know what your life is like without your parent until they're gone, because you've probably never had to deal with that situation. And so there's so many things, like small and big, that my dad did on our family. He did a lot, like he's always quietly, I think actually in some ways that may have been where I got the whole like, quietly just get on with things and get shit done, because my dad was that person. Never made a fuss, just like was always doing everything. But there's so much stuff now that we're like, oh my god, he literally did so much stuff, and we're there like, how are we gonna pick this all up? And yeah, so that's kind of grief, but then it was obviously compounded by coronavirus. So I basically, my dad passed away in early February. I had a couple more weeks off work. I then went back to work for 3 weeks on like a half-time basis, and then we went into lockdown. I think grief is like it's a very isolating experience. Even though I'm in a house with like my mum and my brother and we're going through the same loss, it's still very different, right? Like we all had different relationships with my dad, and we all process those emotions very differently. And so doing that and not being able to see other people or even like access other forms of like outlet, whether it's just going out or like dancing or whatever it is, I think made that a little bit more challenging. And actually a bit harder to just reach out to people. Like I realized before, you would kind of see your friends and you might chat to them about things. But I found that during lockdown, if I was feeling low or a certain way, then I had to put my pride aside and actually say to my friends, like, this is how I'm feeling and I need some support. And just, you know, like the whole world is grieving this normality of life, right, in a pandemic. And so I think my best way of describing it is like grief is a big ball of shit, basically, and you're constantly carrying it around on your shoulders, and it may get less raw and less painful over time, but it's always there. And then a coronavirus pandemic happened, then I had to like apply for my jobs, then I had some other like issues and like betrayals of things from friends, and just a lot of stuff happened, and it all was piling on top of each other that I actually had a few times where I felt really anxious, and I had quite bad anxiety a few years ago, but it really, I think, got triggered by having this life-changing thing that had happened to me, and then everything else normal on top of that just made everything really overwhelming.
Do you think that you've had that support from friends and family? Do you feel comfortable talking to them about it?
So I think in terms of friends, I am the first person in my friends to lose a parent. None of my close friends, anyway, have lost a parent. So I think I have really lovely friends, and they've tried so hard to like be there and be conscious, but I also think it's really one of those things that until you go through it, you have absolutely no idea what it's like, and it doesn't matter how great you are, you just can't empathize with something like that when you haven't been through it. That's where I mean I've had to kind of put my pride aside, because I think sometimes you expect like, oh, you know, why didn't this person message me, or like why haven't they checked in, or something like that. But you sometimes, I think, because somebody doesn't know what it's like, you need to explain that to them a little bit and say, actually, I need some support. But equally, at the same time, in terms of friendship, it's really put into perspective for me who has my back when shit hits the fan. I don't think badly of anybody for their response in the situation, but there is some people who I think I was maybe disappointed at. Like, they sent me one message and then that's it, and they've not checked in on me again. And just people I thought would check in a little bit more, or like feel a little more for me about the fact that this thing happened, and they didn't, and that's fine, and they're still friends. But I think it's created a little bit of a two-tier in my mind, if I'm honest, about the people who I know I can rely on when things are really bad. But I think there's something about those friends who feel for you when shit happens to you. Like, they feel it, and then for that reason, you play on their mind and they check in on you. And I've been really lucky to have, like, one of my, like, longest friends from, you know, we've been friends for 16 years since, like, the first day of school. She's never been through it herself, but has been incredibly, incredibly supportive this whole time. So, family is, if I just talk about, like, my close family, like, my brother and my mum, because that's who I've been mostly, like, hanging out with in lockdown. I think it's been interesting. Like, I think we all deal with these things quite differently. My brother is the epitome of, like, he's my dad. Like, he's so stoic. Like, never really talks about his emotions. Like, a very typical South Asian man. Like, you don't see the emotion on their face. I think I have barely ever seen him cry. Like, and we do talk. We're very close. And we talk openly about these things and about how we feel. But I think we both have had quite similar approaches. It was shit, like, what happened, but all we want to do is, like, make my dad proud and, like, just to get up and get on with things and just live our life in a way that would make him proud, and all the sacrifices and things that he did in order for us to be where we are, and just to make sure that none of that is wasted. And so I think that's been our main focus. Like, even, you know, straight away after my dad passed away, we, like, put so much of our energy into fundraising for, like, the National Brain Appeal, because we just wanted, I suppose, like, make our tragedy worth something more. Yeah, I think my mom is very different to me in how she deals with these things. It's been very, I mean, to be honest with you, I can't imagine what it's like living with somebody for 40 years every single day and then they're not there anymore. Like, I just, I can't even, you know, I can't understand what that is like for her. And so I think she's really struggled to come to terms with what happened. And often actually wants to talk about it quite a lot, sometimes when I don't really want to talk about it. And that can be tricky, because sometimes, even though you're going through the same thing, you deal with it in different ways, and you don't always want to talk about it when that person wants to talk about it, or the other way around. And so sometimes I think having outlets outside of your immediate family, like other people you can talk to who aren't going through the same thing, and so you're not unloading your emotions on top of theirs, can be really, really worthwhile.
One thing I would mention about what you said with friendships and kind of feeling like people didn't always check in, I can imagine also that some people would not know how to bring it up, because I think the last thing they would want to do is trigger you when you're having a good day finally and, you know, not thinking about it for a while and just being like, oh my God, are you okay? That could play a part in why some people may hold back as well from reaching out all the time. Like, even when I speak to you, sometimes I'm like, oh, but, you know, I need to think about what the right thing is to say, because I wouldn't want to upset you. But I do still want to show you that, like, I still care and I'm still here for you. And we've had conversations where, like, you always tell me, like, Natalie, stop therapizing, because I always end up, like, trying to, like, solve your problems. I have this tendency to do that. It is so hard as a friend. Sometimes it can be, like, not knowing how to support your friend.
It really depends on the person, right? Like, what is the best way to support them? But I suppose what I would say is, like, even if you don't say it to that person, they are thinking about it all the time. Like, I can guarantee you that you may think about your parents, like, once or twice when they're alive. When they pass away, you think about them thousands of times in a day. So if you think, like, oh, I don't want to trigger her, I'm probably thinking about it all the time anyway, right? Like, it's a constant reality of my life. So you asking me, like, hey, how are you feeling? And also, that's the other thing, is I wouldn't say expressly, like, bring up how are you feeling about, like, your dad. Like, one of my friends, what I love that she's done is she'll just send me a message once in a while being like, hey, I'm thinking of you. And it doesn't even require me to respond if I don't want to. I think it's giving that person the option to talk about it if they want to, right? Because I consciously feel a lot of the time like, oh, I don't want to be that person who's always bringing up my dead dad that my dad died. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel really like I'm the downer at the moment because this crap thing happened, but I don't want to constantly be that person who's like bringing it back to such a somber topic, even though that's my reality. So I think where people give you the space to talk about it if you want to talk about it is like super, super powerful. And I think that's all you need to do is hold space for that person if they need it. And I think the other thing has just been, even when my friends haven't known what to say or we've not spoken about it. In lockdown, there's been like a real power of gifts. So even just like, I've had a few friends send me like flowers or like sweets or things like that. And it's just brought a smile to my face and just been a really nice way of like, even if you don't know what to say or like to have a conversation about it or whatever, you can show that you're there for somebody in small ways like that as well, right? Just by bringing a little bit of joy into that day.
Yeah, that is actually lovely. It's so nice. And I think it's such a nice idea as well to just be there for your friend and in a way that's not so explicit, but it's like you're still making it known that they're not alone. How do you feel the South Asian community deals with grief? Do you think it's a big taboo at the moment, or do you think those conversations are happening more now?
I think it is still quite a taboo topic. And actually, that's not just in South Asian communities. I think generally, I don't think we like talking about death when really death is the only constant and the only guaranteed thing is that each of us will die and that everybody that we love will die. Like, frankly, that is the only thing that is guaranteed in life. And so I think generally we don't like discussing death. You know, in my view, as somebody who's not religious, like, religion was built actually for a large purpose of the fact to create some narrative around what happens after you die, because you needed some sense of like getting it around your head that you're immortal in some way, like your soul at least. Yeah, I think it's something that we don't really talk about very openly anyway, when I think we should. And it shouldn't just be like when you're going through it, but also generally, like, and I feel like also going through close deaths to you, it really gives you a different perspective on living. It really makes you think differently about if I could die tomorrow, anyone could die tomorrow. And there's no guarantee that you will, you know, like my dad was about to retire and had worked so hard for so many years and never got to enjoy the fruits of all his labor. And that was like a really tough thing for us to get like our head around. You don't know you're going to have that time. And so I think you should really try to live life now to the extent that you can, and balance like thinking about the future as well as like trying to enjoy what you're doing now, because you never know what's going to happen. But yes, we don't really talk about it. And then I think with grief, I think our attitude to grief is very similar to what we have in mental health, which is, it's that stoic thing of like, you just get on with it. Like, you just get through it and you get on with it and you don't make too much of a fuss about it. And I think the reality with that, as you would have with mental health and things like that, is people bottle up what they're feeling. You know, whether it's, some people might be able to relate more to things like anxiety, right? If you don't talk about those things, you kind of just end up bottling them up. I think it's similar with grief. And I was talking to some of my cousins who lost their parents like 10 years ago. And I think some of them were saying they feel like it's impacted their entire life because they never really dealt with it at the time. So I think the consequences of not talking about it can be really long term and can be really, really damaging. Yeah, we don't like to talk about it, and there's just a very much a mindset of like, get on with it and you just have to like deal with it. There's also, I found with my mom, like, everyone's just been telling her to get into religion. I've just been like, how is this I don't think this is appropriate for everybody, but I just don't think that process of accepting these things is that simple, and you have to work through it. And for me anyway, working through it involves talking about it.
So the last thing is, I wanted to ask you, Shirin, what do you have strong game in?
This is like going along the lines of not being humble.
Do it, girl.
Okay, I have a strong game in multitasking. I think dancing, talking openly and honestly, holding space, I think, for friends and family, and yeah, just constantly pushing myself and I think challenging myself and always trying to be a better person. These are my like strong game things. Also like traveling and, you know, backpacking on my own and trying to push myself out of my comfort zone and things like that. Yeah, and what could I have stronger game in? It would probably be like learning how to take care of myself and actually take a break. Being less irritable, because I can be quite, probably with my closest family, they see the worst sides of me. So yeah, I think I could be more empathetic and like a little bit more patient and understanding sometimes, and not just act on my emotions. I can have stronger game in like dance and exercise. Definitely don't do enough of those. I want to be like stronger, and I don't think I give my body enough attention and time. Like, not in the sense of feeling insecure about it, but I just think that I could value what my body is and what it can give me, and giving it the right attention and love and terms of like exercise and things like that. Yeah, I hope that was okay.
No, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing and for coming on. It was such a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me.